Good morning, everybody. So welcome to the session with AXA. We're delighted to have Thomas Birbal with us, the Group CEO of AXA. So before we start the fireside chat, we've got an interactive polling question. So can we have that up, please? So unsurprisingly, question about XL. So what do you see as the key debate regarding the XL transaction? Number one, the consistency with the communicated strategy. Number two, the price paid for the business. Number three, AXA's ability to deliver the intended synergies. Number four, replacing the lost earnings from various disposals. Number five, the sort of cultural and business fit with AXA. And number six, the fundamental attractiveness of the specialty business. So those are the options. Can we please poll? Okay, so pretty clear. So the consistency with the communication strategy. Thank you. So Thomas, firstly, thank you very much for coming to the conference.
Thank you, John.
And doing the fireside chat. So I guess in line with that polling question, I guess the key issue for a lot of investors is, I guess, trust fundamentally what you said in terms of strategy and what you delivered, and you surprised people. And I guess, you know, trust is a massive thing in terms of valuing a share, in terms of multiple and consistency of communication. So you know, how would you address that issue?
Look, I mean, I first of all recognize that there was surprise linked to the size of the deal, surprise linked to the timing of the announcement, and also surprise linked to the business. And I fully understand that initial reaction. But let me try and explain to you how this fits into the strategy Focus and Transform that we have announced in June 2016 and that we have reiterated and further detailed last November. Focus and Transform was about 4 to 5 main issues. And I will show you how XL fits in this. The first one is we want to focus on fewer countries. AXA is large, 10 countries make 80% of the profit, but we are in 64 countries. We are reducing our footprint, we are focusing on 10 plus 6 countries, and XL is very present in those 10 plus 6 countries and will reinforce our position on the commercial line. So no change to that, fully in line. Second topic is around the question, how can we shift our portfolio from a portfolio that is very focused on financial margin to a portfolio that is focused on higher growth and technical margin? We indicated two big strategic moves. One was to push into protection and health. The other one was to push into commercial line. Protection and health has been growing extremely well. Last year, 6% growth of revenues, 11% growth on the underlying earnings. We want to continue this because we do believe this is the right thing to do. And it's also not only a high growth area, but an area where we are very close to the customer. And then you have the commercial line business, where we've been so far successful in the SME business. This is our core business, but where we were lacking the specialties, the US presence, and the larger corporate business. XL does fit that hole and does increase our scale where we've traditionally been very small with AXA Corporate Solutions. Then you had a third topic, which is around simplification of the organization. We announced a reduction of 300 million in cost through a restructuring of the group, of the regions. This is in implementation and is almost done. We have roughly, I think, 20 people still to look for a job. The rest is done. And then we come to the scaling of innovation. We have said we have tested in a lot of areas. We want to focus our innovation on health and on commercial lines. We are now scaling it up. On health, you have seen acquisition of Maestro in the US, which is around population health management, pushing telemedicine from 0 to 10 million beneficiaries in 2 years, And now with Excel, we can also go and push the area around risk consulting. So yes, I acknowledge that Excel has been a surprise, but it is fully in line with the strategy that we have communicated from the very beginning.
And I think if we go back to around the Investor Day, I guess in November, December in Paris, I think people left that Investor Day with a feeling that the messaging was around buybacks and bolt-on acquisitions. So I think the size has surprised people. How do you address that? That the expectation was in terms of capital return and small bolt-ons, and this is a big transformational deal.
So let's start with the share buybacks. I have always been very clear that when I took over, I didn't only take over, but I inherited also certain philosophies from my predecessors. And one of the philosophies was on share buybacks. And both predecessors have always rightly so said to me, look, share buybacks is an option, but it is a sign that you have no entrepreneurial ideas anymore. And therefore, I have always positioned share buybacks as an option, but it needs to compare well to a transformational idea, be it an investment organically or be it an investment inorganically. And we have certainly looked, when we looked at XL, to always compare this to a share buyback. XL has a return on investment of 10%. If I look at a share buyback, it is lower in terms of return on investment, and it has a negative effect on the solvency, and therefore we clearly decided to go for this investment. On the size type, John, you are absolutely right. When we look back, we have always envisioned smaller deal sizes. And when I was talking about 1 to 3 billion, this was the deal size we looked at. But when we looked at the different areas where we needed to fill our gaps, be it in specialties, be it in the US market presence, you always stumbled across XL. Because at the end of the day, XL is not a company that is only operating in the large account space in international programs. When you look behind the curtains, you see that it is a company that is very diversified. 40 different lines of business, where roughly a third is in the specialty business, a third is in the P&C business, both on the US market and international, and a third is in the reinsurance market. So a very diversified portfolio with its special lines of business. And therefore, when you look at the variety of businesses and the global scale it gives us in one go, obviously there was always a trade-off. Should you do three consequent acquisitions that are smaller, bearing in mind that very few targets have the purity that XL has, where you buy something where almost 100% is fully in line with what you have, and not where you buy something where you have to buy other stuff and you need to sell it then. This was the reason why we did the deal. A portfolio of many different areas that we were interested in, and B, a very high fit that we didn't see anywhere else, and C, if you look at the price, a price that is very reasonable for what is in there.
You've always talked about commercial lines since you set out the Focus and Transform strategy. And you've talked about healthcare, you've talked about lots of things in terms of developing the whole insurance business model, getting closer to the customer. On the commercial line side, I think a lot of people expected something that was more SME and more niche in terms of smaller customer types, digitizing parts of the business that aren't digitized. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because a lot of people look at XL and just see like a big global commercial lines business. You know, how does that fit with the SME piece of commercial lines?
So first of all, we are already very strong in SME on the continent. And in this area, again, when you want to buy companies, you always have to buy a small SME portfolio with a lot around that you don't want. So it's always a trade-off. Secondly, when you look at where is our growth potential in SME, it is not by going into more markets. It's by penetrating the existing SME portfolio with specialty lines. We are very strong in the straight P&C coverages in the SME space. Where we are not strong yet is the specialty. Just to give you an example, if you have, a company of lawyers that need a D&O insurance for 8 or 10 people, we are often not capable of delivering this. with XL, we have the capability to have specialty business that we can then drill down to the SME business. So that's the number one, getting an underwriting capacity and capability to penetrate more the existing SME business. Second one is on the larger and mid-market, we always stumbled over the fact of the US. Many of my conversations with French customers went well until the point where they said, okay, and what about the US? We couldn't offer anything, the discussion was over. This is not the case anymore tomorrow. And then when you think, thirdly, risks are moving more towards the specialty space, think about traditional retail risks like a car insurance risks, very individual today, very frequency based. Tomorrow, car insurance will be a product liability, a car manufacturer's liability, will most likely be more severity based to the degree that cyber risk is probably the biggest risk. So businesses are moving towards the specialty space. And obviously that goes then also with the development of the margins. Margins in retail will come under pressure. Margins in the specialty business will be less subject to the pressure of the retail.
So looking at the other business lines that you were trying to develop, so particularly I'm thinking of healthcare and protection, does doing the XL deal, does that slow down the development in those areas? You now have less capital to invest in those parts of the strategy?
No, not at all. I mean, I said earlier, we are very successful in the health business, plus 6% on the revenue growth last year, plus 11% on the underlying earnings. Health is very much an organic play in the markets where we are in. We are the biggest health insurer worldwide. If you take the pure US players out, we have been growing a lot in the existing hubs that we have, the six large markets, but also in new markets in Asia. Yes, there's maybe one or two markets where you could go inorganically and buy something, but these are smaller ones. And again, you know, we have time. The priority now is to focus on three things. One is to do the IPO well. Secondly, is to do the XL integration well. And thirdly, to get down the debt gearing. But that doesn't mean that our overall strategy, focus and transform, or our ambition is being put in question. On the contrary, we've clearly said XL fits into the strategy, we are continuing the strategy, and we have also on three occasions, reaffirmed our Ambition 2020 targets despite those changes.
I think another aspect that people are uncomfortable with is the timing, because you've obviously got a big transaction that's going to happen at some point in the US. You've pre-used some of that financing for the XL deal. So you've got a degree of execution risk around that transaction. And I guess you can never choose timing in terms of a transaction like this. Can you talk a little bit about how you think about that and how you and the board got comfortable with taking that execution risk? And what is the execution risk?
So first of all, it is true that the timing was a surprise to many people, and I would have personally also preferred to do this deal after the IPO. However, the execution risk is very much linked to the financing of the deal. I mean, yes, you have execution risks, A, placing the IPO well, B, making the integration well, but I guess the major concern is around the financing. Yeah. And when you look at the financing, you'll see that the financing has been designed very independently of the IPO, in a way that we have said, look, we have a significant amount of cash at hand in the holding. We want to use of this amount 3.5 billion, and we have more than 3.5 billion as a first layer. The second layer that we communicated on the 14th of November in our investor day was that roughly 3 billion will flow back from the US independent of the IPO, pre-IPO. This is majorly part due to the change in the financing, but also to the sale of the AB units to the AXA Equitable Holding. And then what you have is two other parts. One is obviously a first tranche of the IPO. If the IPO doesn't happen, we have different means of getting to the money, either by disposals. I said earlier, we want to reduce our footprint, and we have started our disposal program. We could also go into more in-force action on the life side. And we have also announced that we want to launch some sub-debt around 3 billion. So the financing has clearly been chosen independent of the IPO. And in whatever case, whether we do the IPO, whether we do a partial IPO, whether we do a full sell down, we will always come back to the 28% gearing, and my ideal would be to go further down.
Okay. In terms of the perimeter, you've got this focused approach now to look at a smaller number of territories where you've got real competitive advantage. You've got the US transaction as well. So there's a lot of assets that AXA is either in the process of selling or is willing to sell. Another pushback we've had from investors is your negotiating position with potential counterparties is weakened because people can see that you have at least a short-term need for financing. Can you talk a little bit about that and how investors can get comfortable with the fact that you're not going to, I guess, fire sale assets, for the want of a better word?
Look, assets in general are quite rare. And when I look back now between the announcements in November and today, I have had many calls of people wanting to buy those assets in the third bucket, the assets that were at disposal. I am not selling or fire selling those assets, A, because those assets are very good, those assets are rare, and there's a competition around the assets. So I understand the fear, but when I look at what I have experienced so far, I can assure you I do not see this fear happening. And again, we have no need to fire sale. We have optionality, which creates upside. Okay.
And then looking at the financial flexibility of the business, I think one of the attractions of AXA was the financial flexibility, the fungibility of capital, the dividends being on a growing trajectory. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how confident you are that you still have that flexibility once you've digested this? And then the dividend, you know, what is the outlook for the dividends? There's a range for the dividend which you've tied to the solvency range. Can you talk a little bit about that and what the opportunities are there in the medium term?
Yes, so we clearly said in the range of 170 to 230 Solvency II ratio, we will aim for a payout ratio between 45 and 55%. We are today in the lower part of that payout ratio, so there is still potential to the upside. And secondly, what we need to look at, when we do now the XL transaction and do the IPO of the US, we fundamentally change our earnings mix. Yes, we are exchanging roughly 1 billion of life earnings against 1 billion of P&C earnings. But if you look at the nature of these earnings, they are very different nature. You have let's say, $1 of life profit that turns into 50 to 55 cents of cash. $1 of P&C earnings turns into 80 or more cents of cash. So the cash accretion of the earnings is significant. And secondly, it will generate a very different solvency, which then also will bring us more in the upper part of the solvency range and not in the lower part of the solvency range. So personally, I would see that as a very positive message when it comes to the dividend outlook.
And then moving to the price paid for XL, it seems like it was a competitive process. There are other bidders interested. Yet how did you and the board get comfortable with the price that you've paid or agreed to pay?
So yes, it's true. We were not the only ones, but you should never focus your pricing on the competitors. You should look at the business yourself and see what is in it. And I think what often is, disturbing, if you look at the XL numbers and their profit generation, you see and all you hear is about the large nat cats. If you look more into detail, you will see that there is actually quite a stable business underneath, again, as I said earlier, based on 40 different lines of business. So you have, let's say, a normalized post-tax earnings of 1.1 billion. In there, you have 1.2 billion of underwriting result, pre-tax, which is very stable over the years. A good combined ratio in areas that are very specialized. And when you think about, in particular, the US, you see there is a certain upturn in rates. So for me, that is a very positive message. And if you look at how the companies in the US have positioned themselves, there is a high degree of execution of these rating increases. Then you obviously have the Nat Cat, which was last year, particularly at XL, a very disturbing factor. We will take a very different profile on this one. So if you take the normalized CAT losses, they are more around 0.5 billion. We will take exactly that approach, which we have always done at AXA, to be less exposed to net CAT and to bring the net CAT exposure down to 0.5 billion, which means we have to obviously add to the reinsurance cover. XL had already been on the journey of doing this at the beginning of this year. We will now go together further. And then there's another component of 0.8 billion, which is around the investment income. It is a large investment portfolio due to the fact that they have got very large reserves. It's relatively conservatively managed, and by bringing it into AXA Investment Managing and by bringing also our own approach to asset management, I do believe we can make more out of it. And then you've obviously got the whole holding cost, the tax in it, which gets you to the 1.1 billion. This is before synergies. If you add the synergies to it of roughly 0.4 billion pre-tax, 0.3 billion post-tax, you will get to a very attractive number. The synergies are calculated on a relatively prudent basis, so I do hope that we will exceed this number. But when you look at this valuation, 1.1 plus 0.3 in synergies, you are at 1.4, which represents roughly 11 times earnings post synergy. That's relatively well comparable to other deals you've seen in the industry.
Yeah. And on the cost synergies, obviously AXA is much bigger than XL, but XL is much bigger than AXA Corporate Solutions. There's not much overlap, and I think you've highlighted that as one of the sort of attractions of the transaction. So how confident are you on that synergy number, given the limited overlap?
Well, look, XL has got a cost base of 1.8 billion, AXA Corporate Solutions of 0.3 billion. If you put the two together, you have 2.1. You have two levels of synergy. One is all the overhead functions of XL that are not needed anymore because it's not a quoted company anymore. And secondly, you've got the overlap with AXA Corporate Solutions. The savings represent roughly 8% of the combined cost base, which is relatively prudent. I would expect us to do more.
And on the Nat Cat risk appetite of XL, you mentioned that they obviously they had a very difficult year last year. They were reducing that exposure, their own volition, pre-transaction. Yeah, how confident are you that you're not going to end up with a big cat exposure for this storm season that's outside of your risk appetite prior to the deal closing, and you end up with the losses but not actually the ability to influence the risk appetite?
Look, again, you get as much risk as you are prepared to take. We have taken a very clear stance that when we integrate the XL business, and even beforehand, that we are integrating it with the AXA risk management approach, which means of taking a much lower risk tolerance and loss tolerance that XL has done. And therefore, XL, as I said earlier, has already started to reduce their net CAT exposure. We are together doing it further before the before the closing of the transaction and afterwards. Our aim is, as you see, to go to a loss of 0.5 billion net CAT and not more. And again, this is feasible. We've done it with the AXA portfolio. I mean, we are also exposed to net CAT. If you look at Mexico, for example, we are the number two in Mexico. We were as much exposed to the earthquake last year and the windstorms as others were, but you did not see the same volatility in our numbers.
So when you're looking at the return on invested capital you expect and you're bringing the multiple down to 11 times post-synergies, I know that in the cost number you've included the additional cost of the reinsurance you're going to purchase for the XL book. Have you also factored into the earnings number the sort of reduction of earnings? So I guess the quality of earnings improves, but the quantum of earnings in a light cat season would be materially higher than it would be post-reinsurance. So how should we think about that sort of risk-adjusted return on the transaction?
No, when you look at the return, you should look at nominator and denominator. I mean, obviously, on the nominator, yes, we have included all the potential negative effects into the equation, coming from buying more reinsurance, coming also from the fact that we might lose some reinsurance volume that we had done with competitors. But we mustn't forget, by the combination of the two businesses, you have a diversification effect that is massive. I mean, European windstorm and US windstorms are well diversifying which is not the case with low US interest rates and low European interest rates and low Asian interest rates. And this leads us to a combined capital base that is 30% lower for the XL capital, so we can run the same business with 30% less capital, which again is another 2 billion of capital release coming.
And just to dig into XL a little bit by business line, I think a lot of it is specialty, it's commercial. There's also a chunky reinsurance business in there, which I think has really surprised people, because that is something which I think is a genuine departure from what people understood in terms of strategy. Can you talk a little bit about that reinsurance business, what it is, because it's obviously relatively big with an XL. I guess globally it's not a huge reinsurance business, but how do you think about that? How are you going to integrate it with AXA? Which bits do you want to keep? Which bits do you want to grow?
So it is true that XL has got reinsurance. Roughly 5 billion of the business is reinsurance. That business is profitable. That business is a niche business where they have pick and choose. And it's a business that is also more profitable than many of the other competitors. When you think about that business, the question always comes, should you keep it or not? What you see is that the boundaries between the two markets of primary insurance and reinsurance are fading, that these are not two different businesses anymore, but that they are coming together. Why is that the case? Because look where reinsurance today is used. Reinsurance is used to look at access of capital pools in a different way. In the past, we were very monoline and said, look, if we take a risk, we take it 100% on our balance sheet. Tomorrow, with having a reinsurance capacity and within that reinsurance capacity, having also an ability to place risk in the capital market through ILS, we have a much broader way of getting access to alternative capital. Not only saying we keep the risk on our balance sheet, but we could also originate, package, and then disperse and seed the risk again through reinsurance, but also into the capital markets. A second thing that you see is, as I said earlier, more risks are moving to the specialty. More and more e-commerce companies require insurance protection that is based on reinsurance schemes. So if you think about a potential rationale between the SoftBank and Swiss Re deal, it's exactly that. And then thirdly, when you look into emerging markets where we are present a lot, we never got a real foot on the ground with our own primary expertise, because all those markets go through the initial stage of reinsurance being the catalyst of developing the P&C business on the commercial line. So when you take all of this, for me, the reinsurance presents a great upside for us and gives us more degree of flexibility that we have not had beforehand.
And how do you think about the durability of returns in specialty, Thomas? Because you look at the, I guess, the bigger picture, you've got a lot of reinsurers, like Swiss Re, for example, are trying to build out their primary business. You've got the commoditized end of commercial trying to become more specialty. You've got the ILS market, which is making sort of big differences, obviously, to net cap pricing. And I guess with technology, will in time sort of creep into sort of different lines of business. So how do you think about the sort of moat that specialty business has?
Look, I take our own experience. We've been trying to build that specialty business for quite some years. Yes, we have advanced, but it takes a long, long time. And that, I believe, is also true for all our competitors. The specialty business is very much linked to the question of what is the underwriting expertise that you've got? What are the key people that you've got? Where is your distribution access and your access to the Lloyd's syndicate, for example? And when you look at the XL as a total with a Catlin part, you see that, as I said earlier, about 50% of the insurance premium, so roughly 5-point-something billion, is specialty. This is divided across 19 lines of business, and those businesses are very innovative. Take the question around cyber. Take fine arts. Those are specialties that you cannot build from zero in a very quick run. So it's very difficult to get in there. And that's why we've also decided to buy a franchise and build it out rather than take 20 years to build it ourselves.
Okay, thank you. So I think we'll take some questions from the floor now. So there should be some roving mics. Who would like to ask Thomas a question? Julian, in the front row here, please.
Thomas, what do you expect to be the most difficult part of the XL integration? What are you most focused on?
So when you look into the XL integration, I think there's three parts of it that will be a challenge. The first one is the actual organizational integration, and also with that, the cultural integration. This one, I believe, is relatively feasible because, as we said earlier, there is very little overlap and it is relatively clear what to do. On the cultural side, I also believe this is easier than what I've seen in previous transactions, because the cultures are very much aligned and there is a high degree of wanting to make this happen, since the logic of the deal was not a cost-cutting logic. It was a logic of combining something that would make the combination stronger than the two individual pieces. Afterwards, you've got the question around the risk management framework integration. I think that is something that starts to be more challenging. As I said earlier, XL and AXA have very different risk approaches on the back end. So how much risk do you retain? I made very clear that in the combined entity, we will go to the AXA standards of retaining risk, not to the XL standard of retaining risk. XL has already made the journey into our direction. We want to go further, and we have agreed to go further, but this will certainly be, from a cultural perspective, a challenge. And then you have a third challenge, which is the question, going back to the SME portfolio, how do we create the cooperation between XL and the local entities in the SME market? Because we don't want to integrate XL into the country organizations. We want to keep it as a separate standalone business on a global basis, XL and AXA Corporate Solutions. But obviously, in order to penetrate the SME portfolios, you need to create a mechanism to incentivize the local CEOs to leverage the XL capability of doing that. Those I would clarify as the three main challenges, but again, AXA is not doing this for the first time. We have many comparable examples where we have managed to do it, but we are paying a lot of attention to those three things.
Okay. Do we have another question? The front row there, please.
I probably divide my question in one of credibility and then competence. I mean, one and a half week before the deal was announced, your management team was in London and confirmed, you know, what you guys have been saying, that do not expect any acquisition before the US IPO. And one and a week later, you know, the deal was announced. And I think it's a record that, you know, your market cap has come down 7 billion on the 12.4 billion deal. So 60%, you have wiped up 60% of the value of the deal, you know, on your market cap. I haven't seen on my 25-year investment life, you know, a deal, I mean, such value destruction, which is interesting because it's exactly, you know, if you look at the XL undisturbed price, $35, you know, it's exactly the 60%, you know, up that was up. So it seems that the market was quite efficient in pricing, you know, the what you overpaid. I mean, my question is that it's around credibility. How come that in a week and a half, you know, you change your mind and you have your CFO, you know, and your management team saying, do not expect, or, you know, we're not going to have any deal before, you know, the US IPO, and then if that, you know, it's the bolt-on acquisitions. And the second part is about competence. I mean, AXA is at, I believe, at an all-time discount to Allianz. So it was a time that we were expecting you to come, you know, to bridge some of that gap. Why should, you know, why AXA investors, you know, we should go to these punts in terms of, you know, the US market can close, so we have an issue in terms of the funding of the deal. You say that you can leverage up more, but certainly, you know, it's a risk that we are bearing in a kind of time that we should actually be building up, I mean, credibility in the market to bridge that valuation gap. And if I may, if you walk away from XL deal, how much would it cost today?
So thank you for your three questions. Let's start with the first one. I mean, you know that talking about deals is always extremely difficult because we are subject to very, very strict rules of confidentiality, not only when we talk to parties, but also to the financial authorities. If somebody had been talking about this deal one and a week, a half weeks beforehand, we would have had to make an announcement. So it's impossible to be able to talk about this.
Quite the opposite, because if you tell the market that you're not doing something publicly, I was in a meeting with 70 other investors, and then you do the opposite, that's perjury. That's even worse.
Look, I was not in the meeting, but all I'm saying is, on these deals, it's extreme. You don't know up to the last minute will you make it or not. Your second question, which is around the IPO and closing the gap, I understand that that this is clearly, from a shareholder's perspective, a logic that makes absolute sense. The IPO, again, I have high confidence in the IPO. When you look at the 2017 numbers of AXA US, I think they speak for themselves. When you look at the timetable of the IPO, we have announced the 10th of May last year. We have filed the S1 document on the earliest day possible. When you look at the comments that we got from the SEC on the last S1 amendment, it was one comment. So I have a very high confidence in the IPO. And again, when an investor looks at the US life entity, they need to look at what is the substance of the US life entity, and that's what they will be looking at. And that's also when we start now the discussions, the feedback that we'll get.
Thank you. Nick at the back there, please. Sorry, did I come back?
Sorry. If the walk away, look, I mean, there is very little reasons to walk away. Yes, there are provisions to walk away, but I do not expect for them to come true. And again, we did not do this deal to walk away. We did this deal because we do believe it's fully in line with our strategy, and it gets us on the commercial side somewhere where we'd have never gotten otherwise. And therefore, I believe in this deal. I do believe this deal makes us the number one commercial line player and gives us something that we would otherwise not have. We did not do the deal to walk away from the deal.
Thank you. Nick.
Thank you. Sorry, I was just slightly confused by some of the comments that you were making in relation to the deal. You were saying in terms of the reinsurance that it was great because this gave you access to offload some of the business into the ILS market. If I think about other players in the ILS market, and forgive me, maybe I'm incorrect, but I seem to remember that the first cat bond that ever triggered a loss was actually the Zurich cat bond that triggered as a result of the Lehman default, and that was way back in 2007 and 2008. So it seems as though competitors have seemed to be in that market for at least 10 years. You also made the comment about XL gave you some attractive opportunity to be able to access the business in and around Lloyd's. And yet if I think about those other companies that have been in and around Lloyd's, St. Paul's was in the market since about 2000. AIG has been in that market for as long as I can remember. Ace has been in that market for as long as I can remember. If I think about the London market companies, RSA and Aviva have already always written that market, that business to the London market, which obviously sits on the same floor or in the similar area. Are you actually saying that was the only way that you could get access to this business? Or are you actually telling us that strategically AXA was significantly behind where its competitors and where its peers are, and that this was a deal that you needed to do to be able to catch up? Thank you.
So thank you for your two questions. So the first question, you're absolutely right. The ILS market has not been existing for 2 weeks or 2 years. It has been existing for a long time. But when you look at the sophistication of the market, when you go back to the first cat bond and today, it has very much changed. And we see that more and more capital is coming into this market with the same rationale that I talked earlier, because those risks are diversifying very well. So we believe, and we see certainly in the US, that this market is developing more and more, it's getting more and more efficient, and therefore there is a need to place more business there. On the Lloyd side, yes. I mean, as I said to you earlier, we had AXA Corporate Solutions, a business of 2.7 billion, which was mainly focused on Germany and France. And we were not present in the Lloyd's, and we had no access to these businesses. And so our question was, are we building those businesses from zero onwards, which we did in the last couple of years, which does work but takes a long time, or should we buy into the leading franchise and immediately get into a leadership position to leverage the access to these markets and also leverage that expertise for our existing portfolio? So yes, we were not present there. That is the one blank spot of AXA in the commercial lines, in the upper commercial line space, and the US. We were not present.
Okay. Do we have another question, please? Thank you.
Yeah, two questions. First, you talked about your better investment capability. Are there other areas where AXA scale could be beneficiary with the AXA business? And the second question, looking at the economic cycle, aren't you afraid that you have bought a PNC insurance company at the peak of the economic cycle?
So when you look at the other areas where I do believe that there are synergies, I mean, investment is very clear. The reinsurance by bulking up, when you think about procurement scale on the claim side, on the administrative goods, there is certainly combinations to be done. So we will look at this in a very systematic way now and see how we can really make sure that 1 + 1 is more than 2. And obviously, as I said earlier, on the cost savings of 8%, my ambition is to do more and do better. When you talk about the peak of the economic cycle, often the peak of the economic cycle does not always go well with the peak of the insurance cycle. When you look at the insurance cycle, we are at the lowest end of the interest rate, so there is certainly, when you talk about a long-tail business, there is an uptick in the interest rate. When you look at the question of rate increases, I mentioned to you earlier that in particular in the US, there is a push for rate increases. And when you look at other competitors, you see that they are able to implement those rate increases. I would suspect that XL has the same capabilities to do that.
Okay. Got time for one last question if someone has one. So maybe I'll just ask a sort of final question. So Thomas, obviously the share price has had a big reaction that hasn't come back. You know, what do you do now to sort of fix the share price? What are your sort of key priorities?
No, look, as I said, I recognize that this was a surprise, and the priority now needs to be to implement on the key points that were the reason why the share price has gone down. One is the uncertainty around the IPO. First priority is now to get the IPO off the ground. We have said we want to do this in Q2. Q2 starts in 10 days, so that's number one priority. Number two is the question around the XL integration. We want to be as fast as possible on the closing. Obviously, we have certain external events, like a shareholder vote, like the regulatory approval in many jurisdictions that will take some time, but the quicker we can be, the better. And the third priority is clearly to get the gearing back from the peak of the 32% down to 28 or even further. And we are relentlessly now working on those three priorities and nothing else.
Okay. Thomas, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate
it. Thank you, John.
Thank you.